Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Theology on Tap. How are you doing tonight? Who here is excited to hear about the Synod and everything that happened in Rome this last month? I know I am. All right. We're living in an incredibly historic time in the church when the bishops of the world have been focusing on the really particular and unique realities of young people. And by young people, we don't just mean high schoolers. We mean anyone who is from 16 all the way up until 35, I think. So I need to figure out the technical age there. But they gathered in Rome for a month to discuss what it means to be a young person in our current context, our challenges with the faith, discerning vocation, making lifelong commitments to follow the Lord, and everything that implies in our daily life. We're so, so blessed tonight to have four participants from that synod. We have two reporters and one actual participant in Bishop Caggiano. Who here has met Bishop Caggiano before? I heard him speak. He's or seen him on Facebook, thank Instagram. God. Bishop Caggiano, just a quick intro, and then we'll start the panel tonight. We want to have an opportunity for each of the panelists to speak on their unique perspective on the Synod in Rome. And then we would like to open it up to your questions as well, and what might happen and where we might go from here in our church, particularly as it relates to young adults. Bishop was ordained for the diocese of, he was installed as the Bishop of Bridgeport in 2013. He's originally from Brooklyn, which you might be able to tell by his accent a little bit later, which is really great. He studied at Yale, as well as the Cathedral College of the Immaculate Conception. He worked for a little bit at the McGraw-Hill Publishing Company before discerning his vocation to the priesthood. Bishop Caggiano also serves on the Bishop Committee for Evangelization and Catechesis, as well as the Committee for Laity, Marriage, Family Life, and Youth. And he was recently a participant in the Synod in Rome. So we're so blessed to have you, Bishop. Thank you for being here. I also want to briefly introduce my boss, Jonathan Lewis, who many of you know. Jonathan has been working for the Archdiocese for 6 years, serving in many different roles, among them coordinating campus young adult ministry, the director of evangelization, chaplaincies, and now he serves as the associate director for pastoral ministry and social concerns. But most importantly, he was recently an auditor at the Synod in Rome, so he can share his unique experience there, being able to speak. We're also blessed to have Chris White here from Crux Magazine. Chris also is a writer for The Tablet for the Diocese of Brooklyn. He graduated from Fordham University and from King's College. His writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, The Washington Post, The Philadelphia Inquirer, Forbes, First Things, among many other publications. And he was serving as a reporter at the Synod recently. We also have Sarah Yaklik from Grotto Network. Sarah, raise your hand in the corner. Raise your drink, raise your glass. Sarah used to work for the Archdiocese of Washington for 8 years in various capacities, including the Director of Young Adult Ministry and the Director of Digital Media for the Archdiocese. But now she serves as the Director for Grotto Network. Who here follows Grotto on social media? They are amazing. If you guys do not follow them, do it. It really is such an inspiring resource for faith and daily life. And so with that being said, I would like to hand the mic over to Chris, who will serve as our moderator tonight for the panel. So let's give a big round of applause and welcome for all of our panelists today.
So let's dive right into this. We were all in Rome for a month. There's this kind of, you know, little musical called Hamilton, where there's this song called In the Room Where It Happens. So that's what we're going to ask you guys to do. Take us in the room where it happened for a month. To start, I think we'll start with you, Jonathan, and just work our way this way. What was it like to actually be covering and participating in the Synod for a month?
Thanks, Chris. Really happy to be here. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. The Room Where It Happened, great song. I won't sing it.
Please don't.
Okay. I'm happy to after another drink. But The Room Where It Happened is called the aula, in like the Italian word, which is a room kind of only used just for these Synod conversations. So there's about 300 or so seats, mostly bishops, and then the young people, we're called auditors, listeners, were sort of in the kind of the nosebleed seats, but a nice perched view to kind of look out. I could see Bishop Caggiano over in the corner on the other side. I could see Bishop Barron kind of just to our right, and then the Pope right in the middle in the front. And so it was really an amazing experience. We have live translation devices in 6 languages so that everyone could participate in a language they felt most comfortable with. But a real privilege. I'd say my Latin from college wasn't as helpful as I hoped. All the morning prayers and the afternoon prayers were in Latin, which I struggled a bit with. You probably are better off, Bishop Caggiano.
Much better.
Okay. But it was a real privilege to listen. Everyone got an opportunity basically to give a one four-minute talk. And so it was sort of like listening to talk after talk after talk after talk for about 7 to 8 hours a day. But really neat to hear from Africa and then Asia and then Europe and then South America and then North America on repeat to really get a feel of what it means to be a universal church when we pray one holy Catholic and apostolic church. To be a Catholic church means to really be a part of a global family. And sometimes in America, we miss that sense. So that was a real privilege to be in that room where it happened.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be with you. And I thank you for the opportunity to come in and really kind of share not only the experience of synod, but experience of faith that we have that brings us together. Jonathan really described a lot of the dynamics. I must confess, to sit there 7 hours a day, 5.5 days a week, listening to people talk on and on and on was like Lent. Okay. But one of the things that I came away with was how beautifully diverse the church is and how complicated the church is. In many ways, with the Holy Father sitting in the, you know, he's, of course, at the dais, at the main desk, and he's sitting there listening. He attended all the sessions, except when he had, you know, his audience in the square. I thought to myself how much I sympathized, and I need to keep praying for that man to try to keep this one family together. And, you know, we all have, you have challenges, right? I have them. We all have them. Some of the challenges that some of the bishops spoke about that young adults face was just remarkable. Allow me to tell you one very quick story. One of the Indian bishops told the story of a young adult who on his way to university was accosted by a group of other young adults who did not share Christian faith. And they wanted him to renounce his faith, which he refused. And they beat him to a pulp and he refused. They threw him into a pit and filled it with sand to his neck. So imagine. And told him he had one last chance to renounce his faith. And he said no. And they stoned him to death. And I thought to myself, this is all, we're all one family, aren't we? We all share the one faith. And yet I had no idea that was going on. So for me, it was a tremendous moment of education, consciousness, awareness, and a great appreciation of what keeps us united as sisters and brothers in faith. So that's one of the takeaways I had amidst everything else that you described.
And I'll just add that you weren't the only one that was really touched by that. The following day, Pope Francis referenced that same story in his daily homily. So it had reverberations throughout. So, Sarah.
And so I was in Rome, part of Grotto Network's attempt to capture stories of young people and kind of do what this is about, bring what's happening in Rome back home to all our various communities and local faith communities. And the thing that I learned while the only time I was in the room was moments of morning prayer or when the Pope called together opportunities for young people to celebrate with him. And then I left the room while all the work happened. But then I got to meet up with young people on their lunch breaks at the end of the evening after exhausting days, as you said, 7 hours. But young people were giving more of their time because they cared about the rest of our generation. And they wanted to be able to be part of that story online because they wanted to share what was happening, not for the sake of building up their own reputation, but for the sake of building up our church. And the thing, the greatest thing that I learned was I'm coming from America where we're living right now in the land of polarization. But what I saw happening with young people, there was a unifying force, and that unifying force was Jesus. And every young person I talked to and captured stories for Grotto Network was all about our faith and all about our love for Jesus. And I walked away thinking our generation could be the generation that rejuvenates the church and heals our world. So it was really inspiring to see that the Holy Father welcomed young people into the Synod Hall and what that meant.
So let's talk about that welcoming a bit, particularly with you, Bishop Frank and Jonathan. What was it like to actually attend meetings with Pope Francis every day that weren't just meetings? He was widely available and around. Can you give us a sense of that?
Well, I was very surprised that the Pope made it his business to arrive about 20 minutes before every session, and he stood literally at the front door. So anyone who wanted to meet him, you could meet him twice a day for all the days we met. And there's no pretense. It's basically he reacted to people just as they were. He took his photos, his selfies. He accepted gifts. He gave gifts. And I was really struck by that. And it wasn't just the bishops. Many times it was others who came that he really spent time and quality time with them. May I just add one thing to your point, though? I think what you said is absolutely on target. The truth of the matter is, you know, we're a hierarchical church. I know that's no secret. So the way we were seated, the cardinals were up front, the rest of us bishops were behind, and then the orators were in the back. But this synod changed the dynamic because the young people who were there, you were one of them, mixed it up. They made their presence felt. They made their energy felt. They showed when they were happy, and they showed when they were not happy. And it got the Pope's attention. And they had initiatives that were not planned, including a pilgrimage, a one-day pilgrimage, which came from basically from the young adults who were there. And there are bishops who have said to me, I can't imagine doing this again, to be very honest, but because it is an experience you do only once. But, I mean, there are many bishops who have done it more than once. And they said, and they said it to you, and they said it to you as well, they had never had an experience like that before. That gives me great hope that what that synod started to do is what we need to do in the church throughout its life, to give it new life, new energy, kind of like a kick, which is really what the church is asking for you to do as well. Jonathan?
So the question, what was it like to be in the room with Pope Francis? It was very clear in the month that there was no fakeness in Pope Francis. He is a man of sincerity. And he's a pastor. I remember growing up, I don't know about your churches growing up, you know, Father always kind of stood at the back of church and greeted everyone as everyone left, and that was sort of a chance to say hi and to chit-chat. And that was exactly what happened that you described, Bishop Frank, in the Synod Hall, being available. And little things that we sort of follow on social media or see online. He walks into the Synod Hall one day when it was raining, and he just kind of walks from his little apartment with a number of other hotel apartments in with his umbrella. And there's this huge group waiting to take a group photo from a whole country together. And he says, "Excuse me, I'll be right back." And he walks over in his little, you know, Italian way, South American way, and hands his umbrella off at the bell stand, sort of where the coat check is. And then by himself, like there were 20 people following him taking pictures they would have taken out of his hands immediately. But he said, "No, I'm going to go take my umbrella over to the coat stand." Just the simplicity and humility of the man. At one point in the Synod Hall, which was really touching for me and many of the other young people, before we were gathering in an afternoon session, he was chit-chatting in the front of the hall. And again, we were kind of 20, 30 steps up in this sort of auditorium. And he starts walking up, and he'd been greeting cardinals before, and so everyone's looking a little bit like, oh, the Pope's on the move. Where's he going, right? Kind of dangerous. Where's the Pope going? And so we were looking, oh, what important bishop is there? What cardinal is he going to go see? And then he kept coming, and so all of us young people were like, uh-oh, where is he going? Well, he was walking right towards us, and we were really awkward, and we had no idea what to do because the Pope walks with like three photographers around him, and he just introduced himself to each one of us personally. And one of the other young adults said, Pope Francis, you should come sit up with us. And he said, I wish I could come sit with you. But he said, we've been kind of clapping and cheering extra loud, like Bishop Frank said, when we like something. He said, but keep making noise, which took me right back to Rio de Janeiro. If you remember when Pope Francis went to World Youth Day in Rio and said, make a noise, make a loud noise. And so that was really encouraging. And just sort of the style of Pope Francis, Chris, that you're talking about. It was humble. It was authentic. And it was sort of going out. He didn't have to come climb to talk to us. We didn't matter at all. There was no influence we had, but he was willing to talk to people who didn't have any influence, and that was really touching.
Yeah, multiple bishops mentioned that they love seeing him actually make the sort of raise his hand to ask to make an intervention, you know, asking permission, you know, the Pope asking permission. It's a great moment.
Yeah, the Pope actually went on the same list as everybody else. So he would put his name on and wait his turn to give his intervention. Of course, when other bishops gave intervention, you could see people on social media looking at their phones. When the Pope made his intervention, everybody paid attention.
So let's dive into some of the sort of thorny issues that emerged. And do you want to grab your drink, Bishop?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, thank you.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here because...
Oh, no, I'm going to put this down then. Yeah, go.
Shoot. Sex abuse was clearly a major issue going into the Synod. Absolutely. It still is today. Bishop and I have just, and Jonathan have been in Baltimore for the U.S. Bishops meeting. And there was this real sort of tightrope that you had to walk between, you know, addressing it properly, but also not letting it overshadow the whole Synod, particularly right. the theme of the Synod of young right. people. What was your approach? Were you happy with the outcome? And, you know, how has that influenced you this week here in Baltimore?
I was the sixth bishop to give an intervention at the Synod, but the first to raise the abuse crisis. And I raised it because I believe in my heart of hearts, not only is it a moment of crisis, but it is a moment particularly of crisis in leadership. If you don't believe in leaders, then you can't follow what they're saying or asking to do. And that was basically my message. And I could see the pain on the Pope's face when I said that. Because my sense is he feels it very deeply. And you know, here in Baltimore, we are now trying to figure out some protocols on which to hold leadership accountable. And we in question and answer, you may have some questions about that, and I'd be happy to help answer them if I can. But the one thing that came across in my time in Rome, and I'd be curious to see if you have the same impression, is that the Holy Father understands and deeply empathizes. He understands that it's a crime and a sin. It's a scandal. It's an evil that has to be rooted out. But he also understands, I think, that no matter what policy or procedures we come up with in Baltimore or a future meeting or the February meeting, it needs to be accompanied by a conversion of heart, those who are leaders in the church. Because I'm a bishop of a diocese that has 500,000 Catholics. I can't tell you how many decisions I make every day. They are all exercising power in some way. If I'm not in the mind of Christ, if I'm not trying to be a humble man, if I'm not trying to be authentic, then no matter what policy exists and has nothing to do with abuse, you can still not exercise power correctly. So the Pope keeps pressing the bishops to have a conversion of heart, this bishop included, to change lifestyles and to be able to live with your people, to live humbly, live simply, live a life of conversion, and to walk with God's people as a brother in faith. So that was the sense I had, is that he has a recognition that we have to change what we do, but we also have to change our hearts. And you need both. So am I satisfied with what happened? We made a step forward. I think February, please God, will make a bigger step forward. But at least we recognize the problem that young adults have with the leadership of the church that is not authentic, that does not have integrity, a major problem. Do you have any thoughts? Any thoughts?
So let me ask both you and Sarah another sort of question that came up a lot during the month, and that was about the role of women in the church. So one of the sort of phrases in the final outcome document of this month was that we need, you know, room for women leadership at all levels of the church. So for you, Bishop, what does that actually mean? Spell it out for us a bit if you can. And for Sarah, what for you, you know, receiving that, what are your takeaways?
Okay, so one of the takeaways I took from the Synod is this. There was a genuine desire, enthusiasm for young people, women and men, to take leadership in the church. But leadership means many things. It's decision-making, and it's moving the church forward in real, real, authentic ways. So I think part of what has to be discerned for us, it's in the Synod document, but part of what has to be discerned is how do you do that and it not become tokenism? Because the message clearly was, we don't want tokenism, we don't want one seat among 14 seats on a pastoral council, we want to make a real difference. We have real gifts to share, how do we do that? My sense is one of the synods in the future, could very well be the next one, will be on this topic. of how do we allow women with their gifts, their talents, and their God-given right to be able to be equal partners in the church, how do we allow that to happen? Let me just say this. I think my takeaway from the synod is, in my home diocese, my hope is, in the not-too-distant future, in the next couple of weeks, I will be able to appoint the first woman layperson to be the leader of a parish, which for us will be a major step forward. Please God, that will happen soon, like very soon.
And what will that responsibility entail?
Running a parish, no different than a pastor would, to be able to do that, because the parish that I'm referring to has tremendous gifts and talents, very well organized, and it's alive. And it's essentially now being led by a laywoman, and I don't see, unless she chose not to, why we couldn't continue to do that.
Sarah.
Anyway, what are your thoughts? Come on, help me out here.
I'll help you out.
Are you going to apply for the job, Sarah?
I like Rattle Network, so. No, so, you know, as a young woman myself, I have dedicated my life to trying to serve our church. I love our church. I love the people of God. And I always want to fully give the Lord my yes. I remember when I was young, really young, and I said to my pastor, I said, you know, the woman at the well, Jesus sent her out. Like, Jesus sent her. He gave her a mission. I said, why am I limited in that? And he said, Sarah, by your baptism and by the gift of what God has brought you to this earth, you have a mission. And he said, and I want you to go out. And I have carried that. I was a little girl. I wanted to have a purpose, right? And I've learned over time that there are places for me in the church where I can give my gifts. You here in the Archdiocese of Washington actually are in a place where I feel like women's gifts are empowered. We have the Secretary of Pastoral Ministry and Social Concerns here today.
Yeah.
The Archdiocese of Washington has a female chancellor and general counsel. And a lot of the major education, finance, HR, they're all led by women. And I think that to me, when I worked here in digital media, I loved being a part of that, saying that our gifts were welcome. And they were welcome in the idea that we have a feminine genius and we have this gift that we could offer the world different than men can, and that there's a place for us in that church. And I think that if more dioceses acted like the Archdiocese of Washington in that regard, I think the church probably would be a more vibrant, holy, authentic, and sensitive and pastoral church. So I'm excited to see what that means and how we live that out. And how you, all young women here, how you can be a voice and be present and serve the church and serve your communities in radical way in your parishes and in your volunteer opportunities and things like that.
So another theme that emerged was the importance of digital media. And I ask about this because Jonathan, ADW, the Archdiocese of Washington, dedicates a ton of resources to digital media. It's being live streamed. Bishop, you have one of the young sort of best gurus in the country on your staff, and you fully utilize his talents. And then, Sarah, you've dedicated your professional life to this. So I'd like for all of you to answer why digital media is important to the church in this moment. But also, let me ask you this. We talk a lot about inequality and disparities in the world, and a lot of places don't have access to digital media in the way that we do in this country. In putting that forward in such a prominent way in the Synod document, do we run the risk of sounding elitist and sort of unaware of the concerns of others who have perhaps more pressing concerns?
Voluntold. I think we always have to be aware of what it means to be a part of a global church. And I think that one of the positive takeaways from the Synod, and Bishop can correct me if I'm wrong, was this sense that there's no one document that's going to relate to every corner of the world. And that's a beautiful thing because there's beautiful diversity and gifts in every corner of the world. And so, you know, Bishop Caggiano said he wants to call a diocesan synod on young people. And
September, don't tell them yet. It's September.
Okay, well, you heard it here first. Breaking news in Buffalo Billiards.
I already reported it, Bishop. You told me this during the synod.
Secret anymore.
But I think we have to go where people are, and that's the principle. That's what it means to be an outgoing church, a church that goes out. And in some places, that's not going to put digital media in the front. But here in our country, in a lot of places in the West, it does. It means we have to go out to the margins. We know from walking into our churches on Sunday mornings that our generation is not there as much. For every one person that enters the church on Easter Sunday, we know that I think it's six who walk away from the church and leave. And so how do we as a church go out to meet that woman at the well in that story, right? And I think we recognize digital spaces of evangelization can be privileged starting points. And we know it doesn't end there, but we have to find every possible way to reach the hearts of people. And as one bishop said, often the best way to a young person's heart is through their iPhone. And so let's start the conversation there by being loving and living out those fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. We could use a little bit more of that on digital media, I think.
This is your world, please.
So I happen to love digital media, but I hated it when it first launched. I absolutely refused to even open up a Facebook page because I was convinced that it was going to take away from my personal interactions. And so I was like adamantly opposed. And through God's grace and different career paths he has taken me, I do it every day. But I do it for a reason. Because I think when Jesus left and went back to his Father, he left that great missionary mandate. And he said, go out to all the ends of the earth and preach the good news. And that to never be afraid because I'm always with you. And I think there are two parts to that command that really could take root in how we as church use digital media. Number one, the digital highways are very, very much now our ends of the earth. And it is also a place that is hurting, sometimes very narcissistic. Sometimes it's a place where hate is spread. And I think if we as church want to transform and make Jesus's love known, then we have to be there. But we have to remember that Jesus didn't leave us alone, that he is our guide, and he's there as we're communicating and evangelizing and encouraging us to be present. And so I think now more than ever, we have to be there, and we have to be there in the most radical and creative ways. And especially now as church, right? We have to be better than the secular press. We have to be better than companies who use digital media in these radical ways. We've got to say that Catholics are bold storytellers and have beauty and the best story to tell. And we have to change that, because when we share that story, the hatred will diminish, and I think there'll be healing.
I have very little to add except this. I will be 60 years old in March. I know I don't look it, that's true. But I'll be 60 in March. So technology for me is a tool. I get it. But you get it in a way I don't get it. And that is one of the unique opportunities for you, my friends, to exercise real leadership in the church. Communication, community, and so much else is totally redefined now, right? With social media. So in many ways, I need your help. In fact, I need to follow your lead if we're going to use that digital continent, is what my term is, to evangelize the world. You know, the truth is, Chris, the highest percentage of people online is in country? Take a guess. Uganda. It's fascinating. That was in the Senate. I couldn't believe it. So this idea that we're ahead of the rest of the world, I wonder sometimes how ahead we are in the rest of the world. So I have very little to say except we need you to take the lead in this, to show us how to unlock it, like you're doing in your work, which is tremendous.
So we focused on some of these sort of in the weeds sort of questions. Let's sort of take a macro look at this again. When you think back on the month of October...
The lost month.
What issues were brought to the table during the Synod that surprised you, or outcomes that surprised you, that, you know, looking back, that just sort of stand out? And it can't be the fact that Bishop Caggiano is the only person that can spend an entire month in Rome and lose weight.
You know, you say everything. Unbelievable.
Never trust a reporter.
Really, I never trust a reporter, honestly. My takeaway from the Synod is twofold. I am encouraged and hopeful because the 30-some-odd young auditors who were there, if they are a symbol of what can be in every diocese, in every parish, there's tremendous hope for the church. Honesty, integrity, kind of like in your face, raw energy, a commitment to serve, that's tremendous. That's one. The second is looking at the bishops themselves, how much it's very hard to get everybody on the same page. Like, for example, there was one bishop who said to me about the abuse of minors. He said, well, that's an English-speaking problem. And I said to him, really? I said, since when do they speak English in Chile? And he said, well, in my part of the world, this doesn't exist. Now, I'm not sure if that's true or not, but when you talk about a global response, there's so many other factors that I thought, again, going back to the Holy Father, we need to pray for the Holy Father because he's the one who's trying to bring everyone to the table. And when you do that, you're going to have to challenge different people in different ways, even as brother bishops. So those are the two takeaways. But the one that really sticks with me is I think there's tremendous hope. There is tremendous hope.
The first thing that comes to mind in terms of what surprised me or stuck out is the story of another of my fellow auditors or young adults named Safa, who is from Iraq. And he was in our small group, but also present in the Senate hall. And again, everyone gets 1 4-minute talk, so you kind of have to pick your words really carefully. And Safa told the story of his friends being killed in a church bomb in Iraq. He went to Mass one Sunday and said to his friends, see you next week. And the next Sunday, before we got to the church, it was bombed by suicide bombers. And he was the one who made the point, Chris, that you were kind of echoing. This digital media stuff's important, but some of us are dying for our faith. And I think that causes a bit of a silence like it just did here, right? I know Safa. We were friends. We hung out during the month. Another young auditor, who I won't name, went back to his country, and there's a group message that kind of blows up on my phone of all of us on WhatsApp. And he said, please pray for me. The police are investigating me and my family because we don't have freedom of religion in our country. And so the fact that I went to Rome and I did interviews and I was president of the synod makes me vulnerable and my family. So please pray for me. And then you see from Oceania and Africa and Germany and Toronto these encouraging prayers of all the other auditors saying, be strong, you can do it, it's okay, we're with you, we're praying for you, be bold in your faith. That surprised me. I think in America, when we pull up WAPO on our phones, it's what's happening in our country. We're dominated by our own bubble around us, and we forget that the world is much bigger than us. And so before we cast judgment on a particular issue or person in our church, I think it's much smarter to take a moment to sit with the lived experience of a worldwide church, because I really came away humbled by being a part of this church that is so much more diverse and facing a diversity of issues that we are so blessed to not have to deal with, yet called to live, like you said, as brother and sister with them. And so I'm still trying to figure out what that looks like, but I do think it means we have to love our moms more, we have to love our roommates more, we have to recommit ourselves to loving the ground we're on more than we are, because that we do have control over, and it starts there.
And may I just add one other thing, too, then? Part of what I was imagining in my own mind, and this is why I would need your help, even in Bridgeport, okay, is those young people who are like you, young adults, who is going to stand up for them? It's not going to be the politicians. It's not going to be the international agencies. They have done nothing to stop the persecution, the inequality, the poverty. But think of the Me Too movement and how that has made so much change so fast. Now, is this a place where you could take the lead, my friends, in this global church? And imagine those young people standing right next to you right now. And to unlock the power of the digital continent, to make the change that perhaps leaders are not willing to make, to make your voices heard. That would be such a tremendous gift to the world and the church. Because if young adults don't stand with young adults, who's going to stand with them? Hopefully leaders, but sometimes you can change the world faster than we can. Something to think about.
So we had captured hours and hours of footage, but only put out, you know, short social media 1-minute clips. But I bet if my team and I were to go back and look at all the themes that came out that we did not release, one thing that was consistent was in us hearing was this idea of looking at the generation before us, wanting us as young people, our energies and creativity to be used and to be welcome and cherished and celebrated, but doing so in the light of saying, how do we bridge the connection back to another generation? And I thought that Pope Francis has always been calling us to that, in a sense, long before even the synod. And I think it was a call from young people to say to another generation, we need strong, credible witnesses. And we're looking to you because, you know, we need help along the journey. And that we recognize that you have great wisdom, but help us see that and help us receive that wisdom. And in the same time, walk along the journey with us. So I was surprised by, in the different interviews, somehow that idea always kind of came back around. And so that desire to say to the other generations, you know, we just want to walk with you.
I'm going to ask one more question, and then we'll open it up to you guys. And this is particularly targeted at Jonathan and Sarah. So, Jonathan, Sarah, what are your hopes from the Synod for the Archdiocese of Washington?
I think, you know, the Synod was a risk. And I said this to some of the bishops there. Because we spent months and months before the Synod hosting listening sessions. Some of you are probably participants in the Share with Francis movement, collected thousands of participants locally. The Vatican themselves did listening sessions. And then it all led to this 1 month, kind of long month, of dialogue about what we heard. But now we have to do something about it. Mm-hmm. So what do I hope? I hope to each of you do something. Like, do something real. Because at a theological level, you know, we could quote St. Teresa of Avila, Christ has no body now but yours, no hands but yours in this world. It's really beautiful, poetic. But also step up and do something. The Church of Washington loses 1% to 2% of Catholics a year. And we're responsible for that. Because we need to be the ones inviting people into our churches. If we're not registered in a church, the elders of that community are missing you. They're missing your joy. They're missing your enthusiasm. They're missing your creativity. And they're missing your energy. They're missing the gifts that you bring. But they can't organize that in a parish council meeting. It stems from each one of us taking that step up and to say, you know what? I'm going to do something difficult. I'm going to do something hard. I'm going to go to meet Father Conrad at coffee house at the cathedral after every 5:30 mass, right? And I'm going to say, Father Conrad, how do I get involved in the cathedral? How can I step up? I'm going to get to know Father Charlie Gallagher at Immaculate Conception in Shaw, the hippest neighborhood in D.C., beautiful church, second oldest church in the Archdiocese, in D.C., and I'm going to say, Father Charlie, how do I get involved? What can I do to help your church grow and to be a part of the movement of Jesus Christ in this diocese? But instead, oftentimes, all of us say, oh, what church do you go to? Well, sometimes I go here, and you know, sometimes go to this other church, but like my friends sometimes go to this other one, so I've still been trying to figure out. Or like, oh, when did you move to D.C.? Oh, about like a year and a half ago, but like I just haven't gotten plugged in yet. Get plugged in. Do something. Commit. Be a part of the change. Not just to like be a lector. Like the gifts that you have transcend any one volunteer opportunity, but it does require you to commit and to get involved. And so if anything we do that Megan says that any of us do in the Archdiocese of Washington, it's commit. Do something. Make a difference because you're worth it and you have it within you. And the church is desperate. Bishop Caggiano gave one of the most moving talks to the entire synod, his opening prayer. There are only, you know, 15 or so bishops asked to give these reflections, maybe not even that many. And he talked about this beautiful image of cracked earth and the water nourishing that water, that earth and that dry land. You can expand more on that. But just this image that you're the water that's called to nourish our parishes in the Archdiocese of Washington. And I'm so hopeful. It's the natural optimist in me. But I know that we're going to make that difference because Jesus asks you to do it. So that's what I'm looking forward to. It's going to be awesome in the Archdiocese of Washington because of you, mm-hmm. and because of what we're going to do together.
Mm-hmm. I think it's no surprise to anybody who knows me knows that I love the Church of Washington. I loved every moment that I lived and worked here. And I loved it because I always felt that the team that was working at the Pastoral Center cared about each one of you. Hands down, people work so incredibly hard because they love you, they love your soul, they care about you. And I think for me, knowing that the Pope spent, and bishops, I mean, think about that. Bishops have an extremely difficult job. I mean, their days are starting hours before we're up and are going many hours while we're already sleeping. And what do? They went to Rome for an entire month because they care about each one of you. They care about our generation. And I think that that means for us that we have a great responsibility. Like the title tonight, From Rome to Home. If what happens in Rome does not come back to the local communities, then that's a sad thing. But there are people who say, no, we're not going to let that happen. We're going to make the whole idea of the church caring for young people come to life. But the only way that happens is what Jonathan has said, is that if we do something. And I think here in this local church, why not be present and vocal on social media, right? You have a diocesan social media presence that's the top of the country. Your young adult presence is always trying to engage and evangelize. The only way that that will continue to grow is if the faithful engage. And there's this whole thing called dark social sharing now. And that is people who are afraid to publicly share about their faith online, so they do so by way of texting, copying and pasting a link. But guess what? Here in this country, we have freedom of faith to walk into a church and celebrate that faith. And as Jonathan noted, in many other places of the world, that is not the case. So I put that challenge to you. Look at their diocesan social media, and not just look at it, but engage, because then you're giving a witness online, and you're helping us as church reach people who are not walking into our church doors.
So one last thought from me, at least, until we have questions, right? When St. Paul died in roughly 70 AD, historians say there were 5,000 Christians in the whole world. When Constantine signed the Edict of Milan in 312, there were 23 million Christians in the world. And in between those years, to be a Christian was a crime, and the penalty was death. So people ask, how did the church grow so dramatically? The answer to that question, I think, kind of summarizes what my hope is for my own life and for yours. Do we have a challenge in the church? Absolutely. Is this a time of crisis? Absolutely. Are there things that we're going to have to purify and renew the church? Absolutely, without a doubt. However, what happened then can help us to do the same thing now. And what was then? Two things. One is what Jonathan was talking about, is personal pursuit of holiness. You are in with both feet. Those were the martyrs. And the second is, when the martyrs gave their lives for Christ, they knew there was a community left behind who would love their wife, their children, to the end. That their family would always take care of them, and their family was the church. So this is my ask for all of us, myself included. Who here is in, really in, despite all the problems and difficulties? In means we're like family. We'll fight, we'll argue, we'll love each other, we'll cry with each other, we'll walk with each other. But are you and I in to seek personal holiness? And secondly, this is a community. Are we in with one another, arm to arm? Will we love each other, be patient with each other, and walk with each other forward? My belief, my friends, is if you and I commit to do that, not only will we see ourselves through the difficulties, not only will we see the vision of the synod, but we will give rebirth to the whole church. And the millions and millions and millions of people out there who are numbing their anxiety with a thousand different ways, will find what their heart is looking for. Their heart is looking for not something, someone. And you know who that person is. It's the Lord Jesus. So, my friends, it is a time of hope and decision. And I think we can do this together. So thank you. Thank you, Chris. Thank
We're not done yet, but yes, applause is due. We've got about 10 minutes for questions. If you have questions, again, we only have 10 minutes, so let's ask them quickly. Who wants to be the first taker?
Oh, the first one's always the hardest.
Hi. I teach second grade religious ed at our parish, and my kids are 7 to 12, and they're starting to ask some of these same questions that you were talking about. My girls are wondering why they can't have a larger role in the parish. One of my older students was asking me about the scandal. So I understand. I know that the message was about people our age, but how do we then take the message down? My children want to be lectors at Mass. They want to be in the choir, but they're still too small for that. So how do we encourage them to stay involved in the church and take the messages from this meeting down to the 7 and 8 and 9-year-olds?
I think part of the response is witness, right? Like you becoming a leader the way that you want to be a leader in the church. And I don't think, I mean, Jesus always said, let the little children come to me. I started lecturing when I was in seventh grade. That's how I thought I could give back. I love the Word of God, and I said, I want to share that. And so that's what I did. But I think that we have to find ways where we are modeling that, where we're actually saying, like, I am being a leader as a woman, and this is how I'm doing that. And let me find ways that you could do that too. And even give them small little things that they could take little ownership or leadership within the classroom. And every little step like that that you take builds their confidence as a woman that I can give back to the church and makes greater steps when she can, you know, greater serve the parish.
And I would just have two other bits. That's an excellent answer. We always have to be honest. So we have to tell everyone of any age, especially when it comes to the scandal, to be very forthright. But the other is, long after they forget what you taught them, they will not forget you. That's your point. And I think you, as a young woman of faith, standing before them, committed, showing how much you care for them, is the signal to say they can do the same thing in a different way. So thank you for your service.
Thank you for coming here, Bishop Frank, after what I'm sure have been a long couple of days.
Very interesting days. Keep going.
I'm sure. You mentioned at the Synod, I have a kind of a three-parter. You mentioned at the Synod...
Three parts?
Yeah.
All right, go. Slow. I'm slow. Keep going.
You mentioned at the Synod that a step was taken forward regarding the sex abuse crisis.
Yes.
Was that to your satisfaction along the lines of what you mentioned in your intervention?
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly... at the current meeting, are you finding that the humility and the honesty and the confidence of bishops or the courage of bishops to reach appropriate solutions to the crisis and the cover-ups, are you finding that that's meeting opposition? And finally, if the bishops, especially those who primarily exercise their ministry in Rome, continue as they have the last couple of months, over the next couple of months, do you confidently expect that the meeting in February will reach solutions to the crisis and the cover-ups that are equally or more rigorous than the solutions proposed and then not voted on by the bishops at the meeting?
Wow. That's a great question. Next question. Okay, let's start from the beginning. The Synod. There's an Italian saying, chi va piano, va lontano, e arriva sano, which my mother taught me when I was a little boy. He or she who goes nice and slow will eventually get to where you're going in one piece. Am I completely satisfied? No. Do we make progress? Yes. When I realized some of what the bishops were in different parts of the world, where how they were grappling or not grappling with this question, we did make significant progress, I think. There's much more to do. As for in Baltimore, I think there is genuine anxiety among the bishops, thinking we had a path that has now been delayed, not denied. But I see that as an opportunity for us to look inside, is what I said before. Because regardless of what happens programmatically or policy-wise, nothing's going to be a better check on the abuse of power, which is ultimately what we're talking about, than a converted heart. So the conversation there is beginning to shift more towards this conversation, which I think is an essential piece. So the delay is not fatal. It may actually help us to address an issue that perhaps if we had done this quick, we would never get the way we should. But as for February, I honestly do not know the answer to your question, except to say this. Many of you may or may not know, but this morning, the Holy Father appointed Archbishop Scicluna back to the Congregation of Doctrine of the Faith. Now, he is the man who went to Chile to investigate and uncover the truth that is there. He was at Doctrine of the Faith, involved in a lot of these procedures to eliminate priests out of the clerical state. So I think the Pope has sent a signal today by reappointing him that he is very serious. But what February will come to, I honestly do not know what's in the works for that.
But you can read all about it at cruxnow.com. last question from... Oh, that was his question. All right, last question here.
Bishop, you spoke earlier about, with the sex abuse crisis, this crisis of faith in our leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And among young people, what would you say to those of us young people who are experiencing this crisis of faith? And mm-hmm. specifically, like coming here tonight, many of our friends might not have really wanted to come and hear what the bishops were saying about young people.
Of course.
What would you say... If you could say one thing to our friends who didn't want to come tonight about the bishops, what would you say?
You missed a great evening? No, all kidding aside, I think to break trust is easy. To rebuild trust is done one person at a time. In my own imagination, what I am looking upon is the Joshuas of the world. You're looking at the old Moses of the world. Those of us who are in leadership now, we have to gather God's people in real simplicity, humility, and lead them forward, and it's going to be those who come after us who are going to rebuild the church. So the truth is, for those who did not come, I perfectly understand it. If I were in their shoes, chances are I'd say, well, why don't I come listen to this guy? I don't even know who he is. And chances are he's going to give the company line. That's what basically, I mean, that's natural. And the only way that's going to happen is to the extent that they can meet a bishop sometime along the way that will break that stereotype, that will give them an opportunity to say, well, you know what? Maybe they're not all bad. Maybe there is hope in leadership. It all comes down to witnessing again. And in Bridgeport, where I am, I try my best to be as present as I can because I know that's the task. But remember, Moses died. He didn't get into the promised land. Joshua did. So in a sense, you are going to be the missionaries to say, yeah, some leadership got it colossally wrong, but not all of it. And you have to discern. And maybe over time, we can give them that opportunity to do that. But it will be a process. One last thing, if I may. Father Peter Cameron, as you may know, is the editor of Magnificat. Father Peter came to the Curia when I was in Brooklyn years ago, and he said something I'll never forget. He said, every human heart breaks differently, and every human heart heals differently. But they heal one heart at a time. And that's what we're about. So I'm not sure if that answered your question completely, but that's what I think we're at.
It's very difficult to distill a month's worth of material into an hour, but I thank all three of you for capturing the substance and the spirit of the Synod, and I hope you all join me in thanking Jonathan, Bishop, and
thank
Sarah.
You. Thank you, my friend.